Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Federal courts are often neglected but incredibly impactful portion of our government. Many Americans have limited understanding of the complex legal network that determines so much about our daily lives. Yet the federal judiciary is a system with the power to affect the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the land we live on, all without making any policy themselves. Today on All Sides, we'll be breaking down the federal court system, explaining how it is structured, how judges use tools at their disposal, and the impact of the judiciary on national policy. Joining me now is Josh Boston, associate professor specializing in judicial politics and law at Bowling Green State University. Josh, welcome to All Sides.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Can you start by providing us an overview of the roles of the different types of federal courts?
Of course, yeah. So as a starting point, most federal courts that you hear about are general jurisdiction federal courts. They're in communities near you. I'm in Bowling Green, Ohio right now. The closest federal court to me is in Toledo. There are judges there. There are federal court judges sitting in Toledo that serve for life, just as there are in Cleveland, Youngstown, Columbus, Cincinnati, et cetera. And all those judges are appointed by presidents, and they serve, once they're confirmed by the Senate, they serve for life. From there, lawsuits can appeal to circuit courts, which are regional courts that cover multiple states. And from there, if you want a further appeal, you can appeal to the Supreme Court, which is what people are most accustomed to hear about. All of those courts are general jurisdiction courts. They hear both criminal and civil cases. If you are accused of a federal crime, it will be in federal court. If you have a diversity of citizenship, of state citizenship, civil case, that could be in federal court as well. And so by and large, when you hear about a federal court case, those are going to be in those types of federal courts, usually in district courts. If you've heard about immigration cases recently, those have come out of district courts in Massachusetts, New Jersey, Maryland, and DC. Those have been the most, in Vermont as well. Those have been the most kind of the big name ones. Those are distinct from immigration courts. Immigration courts are a specific type of court that exist within the executive branch. In fact, they exist within within the Department of Justice. The judges that serve on immigration courts are civil servants. They are appointed by attorneys general. They serve for 15-year terms. And all of the immigration proceedings that occur there are distinct. They happen within the judiciary, quote unquote, the judiciary that exists within the Department of Justice. And there are judges like that across the federal bureaucracy. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services has judges. The Social Security Administration has judges. All of those judges are different. They serve, they're civil servants. Sometimes they're called administrative law judges. They deal with questions relating to specific issues relating to immigration, Medicare. The National Labor Relations Board has judges. All of those are different than federal judges that serve for life according to the Constitution.
Okay. So I understand the federal judges and serving for life. Those other judges you're talking about that are in the executive branch, so they're different. They're not considered a part. Are they considered a federal court still?
They are. We call them judges. They are not federal courts. The proceedings are not. They occur differently. Oftentimes, I have a colleague at a different university who studies immigration courts. They happen remotely many times. Mm-hmm. People are held in detention, oftentimes for long periods, and those immigration proceedings, oftentimes removal proceedings, will occur remotely. Removal proceedings occurring in immigration courts are civil proceedings, so. You are not provided with an attorney unless you can afford one yourself. It's not the same as a criminal proceeding. If an illegal immigrant in the United States was to be accused of a crime, that would be in federal court. Then they would go to federal court. Immigration courts are not general jurisdiction courts. They're still called judges, the same way that judges exist in other parts of the bureaucracy. They just don't have the same level of independence and protection that full-throated Article 3 of the Constitution judge. Those judges have.
Now, you were calling, so there's federal courts and then you were calling them district courts. But is that also whenever you hear someone say a circuit court or a court of appeals, is that a district court?
No, that's a great question, though. District courts are kind of the way of entry. When you go knocking on the courthouse door, if you're going to a federal court, you're going to go to that district court. Right now, I'm in the Northern District of Ohio. There are judges at duty stations across the Northern District of Ohio in Toledo, Cleveland, Youngstown, and maybe one other. And there are judges across those locations that could address issues immediately, or oftentimes it will take many, many months or years for them to hear that. Once you were to have your case heard at that entry point into the federal courts at district courts, you could appeal to circuit courts. So you could appeal to the circuit court, to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. For us, we're in the Sixth Circuit. That would be an appeal to the court in Cincinnati. Those judges then hear appeals. That appeal from the trial court, from the district courts to the circuit courts, is called an appeal of right. You have a right to have your appeal heard. Oftentimes that will not be a full-throated appeal with oral arguments and things like that. Usually, when you appeal a case, it is affirmed. That is, that the higher court agrees with what the lower court determined. And even from there, if you didn't like the outcome at that intermediate appellate level, you could appeal higher to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay. Yes. And so we are in here. I'm here in Columbus, and it's the Southern District of Ohio.
That's correct.
So they have offices in Columbus, Cincinnati, and Dayton, and cover the 48 counties in like the southern half of Ohio. So, okay.
That's correct.
Okay. And when you're talking about what goes to federal court, I was kind of like looking up a list. I mean, there's lots of things: income tax and narcotics law, mail theft, crimes committed on federal property, counterfeiting. Those are the kind of things that go to a federal court rather than just being handled by what county you live in or city, right?
That's correct. Although I'll say, as a political scientist and not as a lawyer or attorney or anything like that, political scientists like to talk about how over the last, you know, half century, century, there has been a tendency to create more federal crimes. If you think about things just in the last 30, 40 years, the Violence Against Women Act, which was highly celebrated, that made certain crimes that would be committed against women federal crimes. If you think about laws that were passed after 9/11 relating to terrorism, relating to the Patriot Act, that made certain things federal crimes that wouldn't have been before that. Even in the instance of certain school shootings, school shooters are typically charged under state law with serious, serious felonies. But now some of those school shooters are being charged with terrorism charges that escalate that into federal court as well. So there are many times there is this escalation. There has been this tendency to escalate crimes which would have been traditionally tried at the state level into federal court.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This hour, we're explaining the federal court system, the complex court structure that all federal cases move through, long before ever going before the Supreme Court. And with us is Josh Boston, an associate professor specializing in judicial politics and law at Bowling Green State University. So if you do go before a federal judge, It kind of depends on the case, because some of the cases would be about just like one particular person who did something wrong. But we hear in the news often that sometimes these federal cases that go before one particular federal judge have ramifications across the country. Is that true? It just depends on the case?
It depends on the case, and it depends on the breadth of the order that a judge would issue. As with most litigation, the direct parties that are before the court are the ones that are going to be sort of touched, and the implications of a judge's order are going to directly affect their relationship, their behavior. If you think about the most basic civil proceeding, the thing that many of the listeners will know about, that is a divorce. If that divorce were to go before a judge in state or federal court, the judge would make a ruling and it would touch those litigants, right? The litigants that were seeking to separate their marriage. Right. That wouldn't necessarily have a broad nationwide or even statewide or even countywide effect. But the sorts of things that are litigated in federal court that you hear about on the news, these sort of salient cases, have often statewide, nationwide implications. When a judge is determining whether individuals can be removed from the country, there are direct litigants before that court. But there are also similarly situated individuals that are being held. And it would seem that if the federal government wanted to comply with an order, that they would also listen to what that judge said. So a judge can frame their order narrowly or broadly.
Now, if a person disagrees with the outcome with the federal judge, do all cases end up at a court of appeals? I can't imagine that every case before every federal judge gets appealed.
No, of course not. But it is a very large number. Tens of thousands of cases are appealed into circuit courts every year. That's changed over time. It varies over time. It's been somewhat on the decline recently. Basically, if you have the money to do it and you really don't like the outcome of your federal trial court, your federal district court case, you appeal it. And you're most likely not going to be successful on appeal. But you might be. It depends on if there is some blatant error in the interpretation of law that happened at the lower court, or something else. There are a multitude of errors that could have occurred, and the higher court can address that. And then, of course, the Supreme Court could as well. The Supreme Court hears a really small number of cases.
And what goes? So does the appellate court get to decide what it picks up the same way the Supreme Court does? Because everyone knows the Supreme Court, the first decision before the Supreme Court is whether the Supreme Court is going to bother with your case at all, right?
That's exactly right. The circuit courts do not have that same discretionary docket that the Supreme Court says that the Supreme Court has, excuse me. But the circuit courts do have a variety of procedural mechanisms that allow them to basically get rid of cases really easily. So we'll put the number at 50,000 cases that the circuit courts are resolving each year. They're only going to hear oral arguments in a really small number of those cases. And even there are some more that will be fully briefed. There are other cases that are appealed and really quickly dismissed. So of the 50,000, we'll ballpark it at maybe 10,000, maybe one in five cases gets oral arguments. I'm ballparking it. I'm remembering from the court data, but really not all of them are going to be fully orally argued. And then of the cases that are appealed to the circuit courts, those litigants can also appeal to the Supreme Court, which does have a discretionary docket. They can basically say whether they want to take a case or not. And there are many cases on paper that look like the Supreme Court should take them, and they just don't. They want to have a really narrow impact on a small number of important cases.
Let's talk about that lifetime appointment piece for a minute. So when you become a federal judge, it's forever. So whatever president picks you, and then the Senate has to confirm you. There's also that step. Then you're in there for life. There's no age limit. Do you just decide when you retire?
Yeah, judges decide when they retire. They life decides for them if they were to pass away, which does happen, has happened recently with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It's a little bit less common with lower court judges. Lower court judges, they serve their time in federal service and they retire to enjoy their time. Some of the older evidence suggests that those decisions about retirements are not politically motivated, that oftentimes judges just get to the point where they can get their federal pension and they want to retire. There are a number of Supreme Court judges that have been in federal judicial service for a very long time, even though they haven't been on the Supreme Court as long. For instance, Justice Sam Alito has been in federal judicial service for over 30 years, even though he's only been on the Supreme Court for about 20 years. Justice Sonia Sotomayor has been in federal judicial service for a very, very long time, just as long as Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito. So they'll decide when they want to retire. For Supreme Court justices, it appears to be much more politically motivated than it does for lower court judges, although some of the modern evidence on lower court judges does appear that they are a little bit more strategic in that.
Yeah, there is some politics in the lower court judges. I mean, sometimes if the Senate and the president are not of the same party, there have been instances where federal judge appointments have been held up and the seat sits empty.
Yes, it's been an incredibly challenging issue for federal courts. The number of seats on lower federal courts that have been held open for a very long period of time. And as with many courts, there are case backlogs. And when you decrease the number of judges by holding seats open for future presidents, because you don't want to confirm under the current president, if the Senate is of a different party, then you're sort of handicapping the federal courts in addressing the important legal issues that are before them.
Well, in the last minute or so that we have left, I want to thank you for giving us a basic civics 101 course. We were debating whether you were going to give us a college level course or if this was like a high school level explanation of how the federal courts works. I think we had a nice balance in there. Is there anything else that you wish, just as in your position as a professor who studies politics and law, do you wish that the average person, what do you wish the average person understood better about this federal court system?
That's a great question. I think a lot of the questions that I've gotten from my students recently about the salient cases that they've been reading about immigration and deportation and how certain things can be done, I think I would advise listeners to think about their constitutional rights, to read about their constitutional rights and think hard about them and think hard about whether they would want to be treated the way that other people are treated. I hope that my free speech rights are protected the same as anyone else's, because if I'm free to say what I want, or if they're free to say what they want, I'm free to say what I want. If I have due process rights in courts and they have due process rights in courts, then we can all be treated fairly. And so that notion, I think, pervades America. And I think it's important to revisit those at these important moments.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. That was Josh Boston, Associate Professor of Judicial Politics and Law at Bowling Green State University. Josh, thanks for joining All Sides today.
Thanks so much.
And coming up, we're going to talk about what tools courts use in their decision making. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
Welcome to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Federal judges have a number of tools at their disposal when forming and enforcing their decisions. As challenges against the judiciary ramp up, judicial power serves as the final check to prevent breaches of the Constitution and other illegal actions from those who would use their power to harm the country. Joining me to discuss the different tools at a judge's disposal and the scope of those powers is Jack Bierman, professor of law at Boston University. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And also joining us is Jay Tidmarsh, professor of law with the Notre Dame School of Law. Welcome to All Sides.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So there's been a lot in the news recently about the concept of nationwide injunctions following multiple judicial orders. So I wanted to start there with you two and have you both talk us through injunctions. An example of this relates to immigration actions. The courts had the Trump administration pause their El Salvador deportation program. So can you explain more specifically what injunctions actually mean for the administration whenever we have a judicial injunction? Jay, do you want to start? No. Jack, do you want to start? You're pointing sure. to each other. Yes.
Sure. Why not? So, well, you know, the basic thing is that Congress has instructed the federal courts that when they decide that something the administration has done is unlawful, the statute says that they should hold unlawful and set aside agency actions found to be contrary to law. So the natural thing for a district judge to do if they're confronted with what they consider an illegal executive action is to set it aside. If that executive action relates to a single person, for example, the young man that was mistakenly deported to El Salvador, then the order will focus on that young man's situation. And the Supreme Court has said that the government should do whatever it can to facilitate bringing him back. But if the executive action is a general rule that applies to numerous situations, then the court really, in following Congress's instructions, sets it aside, which means issuing an order saying that this illegal executive action can have no effect. And that's, you know, basically an injunction. And if the government violates the injunction, then the court's recourse is to hold the government officials responsible in contempt of court and either fine them or put them in jail until they begin to obey the court's order.
Now, NJ, these injunctions have been coming, it seems like, at a rapid pace. for the most part, over years and years of casual observing, I would say that federal courts move slowly. But do you feel like more recently they've had to move more quickly, or are we just hearing about it more often because news is buzzing?
One of the differences is the number of executive orders that President Trump has signed across a range of issues, which have been implicating significant constitutional and statutory rights. So one of the reasons we're seeing as many as much judicial activity as we're seeing is precisely because we're seeing is the number of executive orders and the range of them, and the illegality that is allegedly involved with each of the orders. So that's I think why you're seeing you. It's not unusual at the beginning of any administration where a president signs executive orders for litigation to commence over those orders almost immediately. But it's just the breadth of the orders that has led to the breadth of the coverage in the news about the number of different lawsuits.
Now, Jack, you mentioned how one case can impact one person, but also one case can influence or impact things throughout the country. Because if it makes a decision about one person, but it can apply to other cases that are similar, does that always happen?
Well, it depends whether other cases have anything in common with the single case. But obviously, even when the court decides a case that only involves one party, then that decision will serve as precedent. And if the case moves up the ladder and ends up in a court of appeals or at the Supreme Court, then the value of the precedent increases as the coverage of it increases from the coverage of the court of appeals to the whole country as a Supreme Court. So you always have that precedential value of individualized decisions. But when you have an injunction, it's a much more striking application because it immediately tells the executive branch, you can no longer do what you intend to do because we've decided it's illegal. Now, I should say that many of these rulings are single district judges deciding preliminary injunctions, which means they haven't really heard the entire case yet. And they're just basing their decision on what they consider the likelihood of success on the merits in the challenge. And I agree with Jay that part of it is just the volume and scope of President Trump's orders. But I think part of it also is the fact that Congress has sort of checked out of the major policymaking realm over the last even decade and a half, going back to maybe the beginning of President Obama's presidency. And so presidents have felt the need to act unilaterally more than in the past. And when the president acts unilaterally, they're more open to legal challenges because they don't have the support of a clear statutory authorization from Congress.
Yeah, and you kind of answered this. My next question was if injunctions can be appealed. So, I mean, are some of these injunctions going to go to an appeals court, or do we just wait in the federal judge because they're preliminary and the federal judge will hear the whole case?
So the a preliminary injunction is immediately appealable. Mm-hmm. You'll sometimes hear the cases talk about a temporary restraining order, which is a very short-term injunction, can only be for 10 days. Those are not appealable. But most of the time, the preliminary injunction or the temporary restraining order is converted into a preliminary injunction after a certain number of days. Those can be immediately appealed. You don't have to wait for the end of the lawsuit in order to appeal a preliminary injunction.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the complex legal network that determines so much about our daily lives with Jack Bierman, law professor at Boston University, and Jay Tidmarsh, law professor at Notre Dame School of Law. So I was reading in The Atlantic, it was a week or two ago, about the idea of judges' power and holding someone in contempt. The article was talking about what might happen if the Trump administration refuses to comply with judicial orders. And some federal judges are moving closer to using this tool, the contempt of court. Could you see that happening? Can you hold a president or his administration in contempt, Jack?
Well, I should say that in my experience, that the federal courts are very reluctant to hold federal officials in contempt of court because it puts them in this very awkward situation of possibly fining or jailing federal officials. I think it's inconceivable that the court would hold the president himself in contempt, that's something that a court will never, I think, issue process directed directly at the president. It's the president usually orders someone else in the executive branch to take action, and then it's that person that can be on the hot seat. But in my experience, that's really a last resort. And I think if we reach the point where federal judges are holding the president, or not the president, but executive branch officials in contempt for failing to follow injunctions, first of all, it's likely to be settled at least at the appeals court level, if not at the Supreme Court level. And second of all, if we actually comes to that, then we're in a constitutional crisis that goes way beyond the enforceability of the contempt and goes into basic questions about the rule of law and whether the executive branch is going to consider itself above the law, which I hope we don't come to. But it would really become much more of a political issue, I think, than a legal issue if it came to that.
Yeah, Jay, can you talk more about that, what the Constitution says about the judicial branch and its power over, or should I say, beside the executive branch?
The Constitution itself says very little about the precise relationship between the judicial and executive branches. The judiciary is vested with the judicial power. That's what the Constitution says. But then the question is exactly how much power does that contain? It was settled very early on in the case called Marbury versus Madison that the Supreme Court and the federal courts have the power of judicial review, so they can review executive action. That is not provided for, at least directly in the Constitution. There's certainly some evidence that the founders intended that arrangement to occur, but that is still something that the Supreme Court has claimed as a power of the courts to review the working of the executive branch.
Now, let's talk a little bit about how busy the judicial courts have been. You said that at the beginning of every administration, there's executive orders, and a lot of them end up in district courts. But this is a lot. And do you feel like this is a process? Because especially if almost every decision ends up in an appeals court, I mean, is this going to take years to see some of these executive orders through the system, Jack?
Well, of course, it can. Although, what happens now, the lawyers have gotten very good at figuring out how to bring an effective lawsuit to try to get a preliminary injunction. And once you get a preliminary injunction, as Jay said, there's an appeal of right on a preliminary injunction. So you can get right to the Court of Appeals. And the courts have gotten very good at acting pretty quickly when the government's prerogatives are at stake. So I think that if you look back at the first Trump administration and also at the Biden administration, you saw things get excuse me, get through the courts pretty quickly. So I think that the important things where the government is really pushing its policies, they can get through, and they can get to the Supreme Court very quickly. We see the Supreme Court has already scheduled arguments in the case about birthright citizenship. They already made a ruling on the deportation to El Salvador of the person that was taken by mistake. So the court has adapted its procedures pretty well to the current situation. And so I think it's not likely to take years and years to test the legality of things that the government really wants to do.
Yeah, and Jay, a couple weeks ago we had a show about the Supreme Court, and we had an expert on who has studied the Supreme Court and the presidency. And he was basically saying that the Supreme Court, historically speaking, has just deferred to the president. But he said that things are changing, especially with the idea the Supreme Court seems to be moving faster, taking up more cases. What are your thoughts on that, Jay?
It is true that traditionally there's been a fair amount of deference given to executive branch and executive branch decisions. Some recent Supreme Court decisions are suggesting less deference being given to the executive branch. So that is true. And I do agree with Jack that the Supreme Court has adapted itself to resolving these cases more quickly. There's a lot of controversy about whether that's a good idea or not, and whether we should let these cases play through the system and let them percolate rather than having the Supreme Court come in on these cases at a very early stage. It certainly speeds up the litigation. We get a president able to make policy more quickly, or at least determine what the boundaries of policy that can be made more quickly are. But at the same time, it isn't the way in which the judicial system is structure is set up, which tends to want to prefer to go at a more deliberate, reasoned pace.
Okay, and there are other tools at judges' disposals to make the judicial process easier or stronger. You mentioned like the preliminary injunction. I have these tools the judiciary used, have they evolved over time? Like, 40 years ago, would we have heard about preliminary injunctions, or is this a more new thing?
Well,
Jack.
the preliminary injunction has always existed. And I think that the it's really down to the lawyers have gotten much better at picking judges. You know, when there's a when the liberals want to challenge something, they can run to a district judge in Hawaii or in California where they think they're going to get a fair hearing, and the conservatives can run to a particular judge in Texas where they think they're going to get a sympathetic hearing. And then those judges, once they issue an order, it sort of the machine then sort of runs itself. And I think that while I agree with some of the critics that say that the Supreme Court has acted a little too quickly in making sweeping rulings in these so what they call the shadow docket cases, where it's not the regular docket but the emergency docket, I think that really the Supreme Court has had almost no choice because you have a full-fledged nationwide injunction at the court's doorstep. The court has to say yes or no to that at some point, or if by silence the court would approve it by turning down the appeal by the Court of Appeals, and there's no chance for it to percolate through the system because there's already a nationwide injunction. So it's not like some other court can make a contrary ruling or even a consistent ruling. The thing just becomes frozen. So I think that the way that the system has evolved is sort of based on lawyers figuring out a better strategy for attacking things and placing these things at the court's doorstep where they really have little choice but to act.
And Jay, what Jack is talking about is another term for that, called forum shopping, which is moving a case around the country. Is that a real term, or am I just did I just read that somewhere?
Nope, that is a real term. It's been a term for a very long time. People are always accusing lawyers of trying to find their best judge or their best jury. That's one of the things that lawyers should try to do. But in this context, it has become, I think, a more serious question because of the fact that there are certain places. Jack mentioned a court in Texas that if you go to a particular court in Texas to file your lawsuit, you know the judge you're going to get. And this is a judge who has been quite outspoken about his views on political matters and the powers of the executive. So you pretty much know the ruling you're going to get.
So you're allowed to, I mean, I guess in the case, there's one case where the person is from Vermont. They went to Columbia, but the case they're trying to move to Louisiana. I might have some of that wrong, but something like that. So are you allowed to just move the case wherever, Jack?
Well, there are some restrictions, and usually there has to be some connection between the litigation and the forum where it's brought. And there are times when the defendant can ask for a change of venue on the grounds that there's no connection between the forum that's been chosen and the particular litigation. But in many situations, like if the state of Texas is challenging, for example, President Obama's DACA program, the deferred action in immigration, there's no one, it doesn't look funny at all for them to bring that case in Texas. It's the state of Texas litigating the case. Historically, what Congress has done in some periods is react to this by requiring three judges before certain orders can get issued. So there was the Three Judge Court Act, most of which has been repealed, but that was used during the civil rights movement in the 50s to limit the ability of single federal judges to do some of the things that single federal judges have the power to do now. And if we had a functioning policymaking Congress, we might have seen something like that over the last 10 years, where they reinstituted the Three Judge Court Act, which would require three federal judges to issue certain kinds of orders restraining the government from taking action.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and you're hearing from Boston University Law Professor Jack Bierman and Notre Dame Law Professor Jay Tidmarsh. They're going to stay with us. Before we take the break, we'd like to make a correction. In our first segment, it was mentioned that immigrants did not have rights to legal representation. Everyone, regardless of citizenship status, has the right to legal representation in the U.S. according to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So just making that quick correction right there. And coming up, we're going to talk about how the judicial system impacts the creation of policy. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive.
Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Judicial decisions play a major role in national policy. Whether immigration, abortion, or student loan forgiveness, judicial decisions constantly have significant impacts on the daily lives of millions of Americans. With the power that the courts have, today we're working to understand how the federal court system affects our lives and why it is imperative for a healthy democracy. Still with us, Jack Bierman, professor of law at Boston University, and Jay Tidmarsh, professor of law at Notre Dame. Thanks again for being here, Jack and Jay.
Welcome.
So in the introduction to the show, I said that the federal judiciary is a system with the power to affect the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the land we live on, all without making any policy themselves. So I wanted to dig into that a little bit more. One issue that the courts are heavily involved in is the use of public lands, the use of natural resources. Can you explain why a court ruling on these type of issues is so important? Jack, we can start with you.
Okay, well, you know, the court is reactive in the sense that the court really doesn't have any power to declare policy without some authorization from Congress. But when Congress has passed numerous laws that are highly protective of wilderness areas and endangered species and clean air and clean water, and when an administration changes its enforcement model, as the current administration is easing up on enforcement of many environmental restrictions, then those changes will get challenged, and the courts will rule on the legality of the agency's decisions. And they'll also rule to a very small extent, but they can also rule even on the policy wisdom of it, in the sense that if the administration can't come up with any rational explanation for the action it's taking in some environmental or health and safety area, then the court will invalidate it. So the courts are sort of a backstop, making sure that Congress's instructions are being followed by the executive branch.
Yeah, Jay, let's talk about that a little bit more. So yeah, Congress can pass a law saying that there's a certain water quality standard or there's a certain air quality standard, and then someone can sue or take it to court for numerous reasons. So is this the judiciary is basically like weighing in but not changing a law? Is that right, Jay?
That's right. It's exactly as Jack had said, that they're reactive and they are enforcing the law or enforcing regulations that Congress has allowed the executive branch to make under that law. But the court itself is not writing the law or determining what that standard ought to be.
Now, why do courts have the authority to review government policy? Is that something that has just been, is it a part of the Constitution that the court can review these things?
Jack? Well, Jay before mentioned Marbury versus Madison.
Yeah.
And Marbury versus Madison said basically that the courts enforce the law, but when it comes to executive policy, that's up to the executive branch. And the tradition in our country for a long time, and really going back to English law, was that unless the legislature gave the executive branch no discretion whatsoever, that whenever the executive branch took discretionary action, the courts really had no role to play. But when the administrative state started growing, the laws that Congress passed creating and regulating the agencies included provisions for judicial review. And then in 1946, Congress passed the Administrative Procedure Act, which was a landmark piece of legislation, which basically subjected all agency action to judicial review, both for legality and for policy wisdom, by saying that the courts have the power to set aside agency action that's arbitrary or capricious or an abuse of discretion. So really, it's a statutory creation that puts the courts as the supervisors of administrative action. And it's a wise choice by Congress, because we wouldn't want to have completely unchecked executive power, given the breadth and scope of all of the powers that Congress has delegated to the executive branch.
Jay, help me out here. So what does arbitrary or capricious mean? I'm
could
not
talk
a,
a
I'm not a,
very
I'm
long
not a,
time.
yeah, I'm not a lawyer, so yeah, use a smaller word.
And you know, the other phrase that Jack also used, abuse of discretion, can help in that regard as well. In other words, if the executive branch chooses an action that is within the realm of what it appears that Congress has allowed under a statute, then the courts can't do anything about it. Arbitrary, capricious, abuse of discretion typically means that the executive branch is acting where there is no basis whatsoever in the evidence or in the record. It's making a choice that is contrary to evidence, or else it is making a choice that the law simply doesn't permit. But it's a fairly, I don't want to say extreme standard, but it's one that allows an awful lot of deference to the executive branch if there's evidence for what the executive branch is doing and if there's a legal basis that supports what the executive branch is doing.
I also hear about cases sometimes coming before judges because the law or what the executive branch has done, is too, I don't I'm not I don't know what word to use, but is too hard. It's too hard for it to be implemented, or it's like too it's going to take too much money, too much work to do. What is there a word I'm missing there for that, Jack?
I'm not sure, but
Yeah.
if there's a if the executive branch promulgates a rule, let's say requiring industry to do something, and it turns out that it's impossible to do it,
That's what I
or
mean.
that it would
Yeah.
cost, or that it would cost so much that it's not feasible. I mean, it would drive all the businesses out of existence because they couldn't do it. Then usually the courts will come up with some statutory basis for saying that the executive has gone too far, and they can strike it down. So, you know, and normally the statutes have built-in safeguards that say, you know, that the agency can't order someone to do something which is infeasible, you know, or impossible. And you know, often the subjects of regulation complain that the agencies are doing something which is just impossible for them to comply with, you know, and then if it gets upheld, lo and behold, they end up complying. But and you know, one of the great examples of that is the Clean Power Plan, which all of the power generators said, well, we could never comply with this. And the Supreme Court actually struck that down, saying it was beyond the EPA's power to co require it. But in the meanwhile, before the thing got struck down, all of the power companies were already complying with it. So it turned out it was feasible, but it wasn't legal.
Now, in recent years, the courts have been used by advocates for the minority party, so whoever's in the minority party, to stall the majority's legislative agenda. Can you explain that process, and whether it's been happening more and more? Jay, we can start with you.
It seems like it. I think in more recent years, and again, part of this relates to what Jack had also said earlier, the inability of Congress often to legislate, and rather the executive taking through executive orders or other executive action, taking more and more responsibility and power. So that underlies a lot of this, the sort of attempts by the courts to regulate executive action to a greater extent.
Yeah,
I would say it's
go ahead.
not so much the minority party. You don't really see often members of Congress rushing to the courts to stop some law from going into effect that they law you know that they were in the minority on in Congress. But basically, it's the interest groups, you know, the people affected. So there'd be, you know, like if it's the Republicans are in control, and you'll have all these environmental groups that run into court, or immigration advocacy groups run into court as soon as the, you know, Congress passes a new statute, or the executive issues a new order. And then on the opposite side, you'll see if the when President Obama, you know, did his immigration actions, when President Biden did his loan forgiveness, you know, his federal student loan forgiveness actions, you'll see interests on the other side, you know, on the conservative side, rush into court to try to stop it. It's not so much the politicians that are doing it. It's just the interest groups that lost out in the lobbying, in the, you know, in the Congress or in the executive branch, that end up using the courts. And, you know, that's a great thing about our system in a certain sense, which is that if the law is there, it's an important aspect of having a rule of law in a democracy, that any person can bring their case to court and get a hearing. You know, your member of Congress may not take your phone call. You know, you can't call the president and tell the president what you think the president ought to be doing. But you can go to court, and if you have a claim that's a viable legal claim, they have to listen to you. And that's I think, a really important part of the way that we maintain participatory system of government, given how big and how sprawling the government has become.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the complex legal network of the federal judiciary with Jack Bierman, law professor at Boston University, and Jay Tidmarsh, law professor at the Notre Dame School of Law. I wanted to talk a little bit more because it keeps coming up about the non-functioning Congress that hasn't been able to pass many things. There's been more executive orders than ever. Our founding fathers, when they wrote the Constitution and laid out the executive, legislative, and judicial branches, do you think they foresaw, or like, do you think they would know that we'd end up with such problems with just by getting a bipartisan bill passed? Jay, do you think that was in the realm of thinking?
Well, the Constitution was set up not to make it easy to pass legislation. So you have to get it through both houses of Congress. You have to get it past the president. Of course, if the president vetoes it, then you have to get two-thirds majority in both of the houses to pass legislation. So it was certainly anticipated that it was not going to be an easy matter to pass legislation. The founders may or may not have had, certainly they wouldn't have had a sense of the modern two-party political system. They might have had some sense that there might be parties developing, but not in the way in which we have them today. And that certainly, I think, is another factor that plays into the difficulty in Congress of getting legislation through.
Jack, what do you think? Do you think that this non-functioning Congress, as you called it, was a possibility back in, 1776?
Well, there were some pretty significant disagreements among the people that were involved in the framing of our Constitution. Remember, we had a Constitution before this one that failed, and there was a lot of unrest over that, and there were rebellions against what the federal government was doing in different parts of the country. So I don't think they thought everything was going to be sort of kumbaya and everyone was going to, get together in a rowboat and sing a song and go along together. There were pretty significant differences. Just watch the play Hamilton. But I think that the framers probably never anticipated. I doubt the framers anticipated the degree to which policy would be made in the executive branch and outside of Congress. And that's a product both of the gridlock that we are experiencing now in Congress, and also the sort of complexity of the problems that the government has to deal with. There are certain things that Congress would never anticipate passing statutes on. They would absolutely delegate the authority to people in the executive branch to carry out the overall policies that are set by Congress. So I think it's a combination of those things. And I don't my own personal view is that what the framers thought ought to be done really ought to be pretty much irrelevant, because we have to deal with today's world and today's problems, and we have today's the people of the country today, that's their wishes and their welfare that ought to be the what the government pays attention to, not what a group of people in 1789 might have thought in a different world, living in a different, completely different set of problems and circumstances.
In the just couple of minutes we have left, I wanted to end by asking you, since you both are law professors, you've studied this for a long time, are there any particular cases moving through the system that you are looking out for, or ones that you feel like are really going to just be telling, and a big thing that you'll be studying with your students next year? Jay, is there anything, what are you looking out for?
The case that most immediately catches my attention is the birthright citizenship case, which may or may not, and this is one of the things we'll have to see, may or may not say anything about birthright citizenship. It actually appears as though the court is going to limit itself to talking about this question of the nationwide or universal injunction that I know you've been talking about earlier this hour as well. And so we may finally have some clarity on the question on that question of the scope of a judicial order. That's the first thing that I'm looking for.
Jack, what's something that you'll be looking out for and teaching in the near future?
Well, I'm very interested in the cases that are challenging the FCC's rulemaking authority in terms of subsidies to schools and such, because the court may decide a question that sounds like a technical legal question, but it actually isn't, which is called the non-delegation doctrine, which really is just how much discretion can Congress give to agencies to make policy. And it's for almost 100 years, the court has not struck anything down on that basis. And if the court rules against the agency in this case and writes a sweeping opinion, which some justices have said they would like to, then we could see a major contraction of agency power to make policy. And if you combine that with a Congress that's not making much policy, what you have basically is a situation where the federal government could be really restricted in its ability to take care of the health and welfare of the American people.
Is that a case the Supreme Court's already heard, or is that coming?
They're going to hear it soon.
Okay.
And it's this term, so it's going to be decided, you know, presumably by the end of June.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time. Thank you to Jack Bierman, a law professor at Boston University. Thanks for joining us, Jack.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And Jay Tidmarsh, law professor at the Notre Dame School of Law. Thank you, Jay, for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And this is All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News. I want to say thank you to our staff, senior producer Marcus Charleston, producer Aaron Esmont-Rabinowitz, student producers David Stein, Iza Huck, and Colin Simpson. And thank you to Chris Corcoran, who produced this show. Video production by The Ohio Channel, board operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.